There is something special happening today on The Line of Fire. Join my special guest host, Dr. Frank Turek.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you. I've been with you before on the Line of Fire. Dr. Brown on his way to India again. The man has a great ministry over there, so pray for him as he travels. We're going to talk today and this half hour and into the second half hour about a book that you need to get for the holidays. This is the perfect holiday gift. The book is called The Emmaus Code. I don't know if you've heard about it yet. You need to hear about it. The Emmaus Code was written by my friend David Limbaugh, brother of Rush Limbaugh. And David, in recent years, many of you listen to this program have probably heard of David Limbaugh. He's been in the political realm quite a bit. But his last two books, including this one, The Emmaus Code, they don't have much to do with politics and everything to do with Jesus. And in the Emmaus Code, which David will tell you about here right after the first break, we're going to have him live on the Line of Fire. The Emmaus Code, he'll explain what the title's all about, but it really is about Jesus in the Old Testament. Yes, I said that right. Jesus in the Old Testament. The listeners here at the Line of Fire show will understand that because Dr. Brown is an expert in the Old Testament, has his PhD in Semitic languages from NYU, and he is the guy writing all the books that is talking about Jesus in the Old Testament and how some Jewish believers, or I should say some Jews who don't believe in Jesus but are serious about the Old Testament, try and say, no, the Messiah is not found in Jesus, and the prophecies that Christians put forth to try and say are pointing to Jesus in the Old Testament aren't really pointing to Jesus. Michael Brown is an expert at that. David Limbaugh has taken those thoughts and many of his own and others, many other scholars, and put them into this amazing book called The Emmaus Code. And if you haven't seen Jesus in the Old Testament before, if you get this book, you will see that Jesus really is throughout the Old Testament on virtually every page. And you're going to say, how can that be, Frank? Well, you're going to see because David's going to explain it. Now, I don't know if you've seen his previous book. It's just a year old. It's called The Jesus Trial. And The Jesus Trial, David, it's basically an apologetics book. An apologetics book that artfully tells his journey from skepticism about the Bible to his realization that the Bible's actually true. It's not a collection of fanciful myths, as Limbaugh points out in his book. But it's God's written revelation to the very creatures he created and then came to save. Now, this new book, I think, is actually making a more difficult case, but he makes it beautifully. The new book is showing that Jesus is all throughout the Old Testament. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, how could the Old Testament, even if it's part of God's Word, have much bearing on our lives today? After all, the Old Testament, it's called old, not primarily because of its age, but because it describes the history of the Old Covenant that God had with ancient Israel, much of which contains rules and regulations that do not apply to believers today. Not only that, there's a puzzling array of characters and events that, devoid of any historical context, often make the storyline very difficult to understand. And some even say, particularly the new atheists, as you know, will say, hey, this is morally questionable. Well, what really is the truth? What really is the truth? Well, we're going to talk to my friend David Limbaugh right after the first break here on The Line of Fire. If you haven't heard of the kind of work that I've been doing, our website is called crossexamined.org. I've been a guest several times on Michael's program here, The Line of Fire. Check out crossexamined.org with a D on the end of it. And I was the co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, which is a book David Limbaugh wrote the foreword for. So we're going to check into David's new book, The Emmaus Code, right after the break. You're not going to want to miss this. Do not touch that dial. Back in only 2 minutes.
Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you, crossexamined.org. Dr. Michael Brown on his way to India. Pray for his trip. He is a warrior and has a great ministry over in India. Today, we're talking to my friend David Limbaugh. His new book is called The Emmaus Code, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament. Friends, let me just tell you, I had the privilege of reading this book before it came out, putting an endorsement on it. This is the perfect book to give somebody this Christmas season. Because who else is talking about Jesus in the Old Testament? And this book is written for anybody. Anybody can understand it. David does a great job laying it out. Hey, David, thanks for being on the show.
Frank, thanks for having me. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, I know you've been talked out on this book because you've been doing interviews for the past month since it's come out. It's been doing very well. I don't know if Dr. Brown's audience has heard about it. That's why I wanted to have you on the program here today. First of all, tell us what the Emmaus Code, where does that title come from?
Well, as your audience members are probably aware, there's a story called the Emmaus Road story from Luke chapter 24, where two of Jesus' disciples are walking along the road to Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and they're despondent, downcast, dejected, because Jesus died, a humiliating death, in fact, did not live up to their expectations of what a Messiah should be and politically deliver them from Roman authority. And so they just didn't, their whole world was crumbling about him. So Jesus appears out of nowhere and begins to talk to them, ask them what they're talking about. Now they are made not to recognize him, the Gospel of Luke says, supernaturally. And so they say, are you the only guy in the whole world who doesn't know what's been going on around here for the last few months, few years, and especially the last few days? Jesus died, his body missing from the tomb. And at that point, he opens up all of the scriptures from Moses, the law, the prophets, meaning the Old Testament, because the New Testament had not been written, and showed how all the Old Testament pointed to him. Every page is permeated with Jesus Christ. And so, after they broke bread with him and he left as quickly as he'd come, they said to each other, did our hearts not burn within us as he revealed himself to us? This is the greatest Bible lesson ever given in the history of the world and that ever will be given in the history of the world. If I were allowed to go back in history to one event, that would probably be it, to listen in, as long as I understood the language they were speaking in, Aramaic or whatever it was. I would love to be transported back, because that's the greatest Bible lesson given by the Son of God. And they said, did our hearts not burn within us? Meaning they had had such an epiphany and such a rush of ecstasy, as they spiritual ecstasy, as they realized that they had been talking to the Son of God, and that the entire Bible now made sense to them. What had been the scales on their eyes had been removed. And now we have it. So my thesis in this book, and it's not original with me, as I said, it's original with Jesus, is that the Old Testament all points to Jesus Christ. And so the key or the code to unlock the Old Testament is to realize its Christ-centeredness. So what this book does, it's kind of an Old Testament primer for lay people and for people who do have some knowledge of theology in the Bible, because I think I've got a lot of sources in there, and you can speak to that. And you were gracious to review and vet it before it went out. And I believe that the entire Old Testament does point to Jesus Christ. And I've laid out explicitly the 10 or 11 different threads that foreshadow and prefigure Christ throughout, such as the covenant, the typology, the Christophanies, which are appearances of Christ before his incarnation, and the prophecies. I intend it to be a comprehensive look at all the ways that the Old Testament points to Christ. In addition, I go through every book of the Old Testament individually, give a summary and overview of the book, and then specifically detail how each one of them individually points to Christ. And then finally, I also dedicate two chapters to summarizing and outlining Old Testament history, because my thought has been that people get hung up on the Old Testament because they get lost in the names, the genealogies, the kings, and if I could prepare a summary of the Old Testament and they would get a notion of the grand sweep of Old Testament history, they would be less distracted, less intimidated, and have a better chance of absorbing the message. So the whole book, it's what I was telling my brother Rush, and I thought about this even after our interview on your show. It came to me, it's crystallized. This is the book that I wish I had had available to me 20 to 25 years ago when I became a Christian. I was on fire for the Bible, realized that the Old Testament was Christ-centered, but wanted to inhale as much theological and biblical knowledge as I could, as quickly as I could. This is the kind of book that I wish I would have had. And I'm not saying I've done the world a great service by doing it. I'm not boastful about it. I'm not saying that the inspired Word of God needs my help. I am saying that God created us in His image as relational beings, and He wants us to help each other. That's why we have pastors. That's why we have Bible teachers. We have writers. I have profited, for example, immensely from your mentorship, and I'm not saying that to suck up. It's a fact. And I've profited immensely from your apologetics work and from our theological discussions that we've had through the years. It's reinforcing, it's encouraging, it's faith-building, and it enhances our faith walk. You know, sometimes we err on the side of being too cerebral about this stuff,
right?
And that would shock atheists who don't think there's anything intellectually challenging about the Bible. They're just so misguided about that. But it's enriching, and it's helped. And I hope that this book helps other people like it helps me, because
well,
the
book
has gone on for me. Yeah.
The book is called The Emmaus Code, and it's written by my friend David Limbaugh, our guest today. You're listening to The Line of Fire, normally with Dr. Michael Brown. My name is Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Brown today and tomorrow. And it's about finding Jesus in the Old Testament, The Emmaus Code. That's why this is a perfect book to get for somebody this Christmas season. And David, I liken this book to getting the box top to a jigsaw puzzle, because in the Old Testament, if you're not familiar, as you said, with the names and the historical context and what's going on at that time and the geography and all that, you can just dive in the Old Testament and go, I can't really see the big picture here. But what the Emmaus Code gives you is the box top to a jigsaw puzzle. It helps you put the pieces together, which is so important if you're going to understand the Old Testament. Now, another thing I love about it is the fact that you are such a student. You've attended some classes at Southern Evangelical Seminary. You've dove into the Logos software program. How did you cull out some of these gems from these scholars over the years that you quote in this book, The Emmaus Code?
Well, so I have been so blessed with, as I said, good mentors and good teachers. And then I just kind of have an antenna for people I can trust. I don't go to kooks. I go to mainstream evangelicals and even Catholics, some of the books I've read, The Life of Christ by Fulton Sheen. But I'm definitely an evangelical and not a Catholic, though I have great respect for Catholics. Whether it's discernment or whatever it is, I have a good sense of that, and I stay mainstream, people that I can rely on, and all the greats. And I discovered early on that some of the greatest writing is from the old guys,
right?
Dr. Spurgeon, Charles Spurgeon. Oh my gosh! If people haven't been, Warren Wiersbe, Ray Steadman, I've some of these great Bible teachers that I thought, and then in the Logos Bible software, I honestly, this is not a lie, I have 21,300 and something books. Some of them are not full books; they're resources or whatever.
21,000.
Oh man! Yes, I've been a fanatic. I know. I've just continued to, that's been my one evil indulgence, where I keep spending money on accumulating this library. And they're all, Frank, as you know, they're all searchable. And so when I began this, Christ in the Old Testament, Jesus in the Old Testament, I did all these searches and I accumulated hundreds of books. And it's fascinating because, you know, if I would have come across one book that did this comprehensively, I would have been depressed. I was, oh no, this book has already been written. But in fact, there are so many people that have written on this subject, but they've hit on different aspects of it. You know, the prophecies are the Christophanies are the covenant, Christ in the covenant.
Right.
I have individual books for each one of the categories, but I made this comprehensive and to include everything that to reconstruct what Jesus might have told. And by the way, told those disciples on the Emmaus Road, we don't have to guess. This isn't some fanciful hypothetical or projection or imagination. We now have the New Testament. God gives us progressive revelation. The New Testament now makes clear what was in shadowy form in the Old. We see the Old Testament through New Testament lenses. So I don't make this stuff up. It's all in the Bible.
It is. Well, hold the thought. We're going to come back with David Limbaugh, his new book, The Emmaus Code, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament. If you want to join us, 866-348-7884. See you in just 2 minutes.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you from crossexamined.org. Dr. Brown on his way to India. I'll be here with you today and tomorrow. Please pray for Dr. Brown as he ministers in India again. My guest today on this in this half hour is David Limbaugh. His new book, The Emmaus Code, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament. A perfect book to get somebody for Christmas. And David, I'm looking at page 82 right now here in The Emmaus Code. And on page 82, you have several different ways in which Christ is found in the Old Testament. I don't know if you want to give an overview or just pick a couple of them, but just take it from here.
Yeah, there are. Can you hear me now? Or is there?
Yeah, I got you. Go ahead.
Okay, there are Christ's work in the creation. He was actually a creation agent. He was with the Father and the Holy Spirit, and the Bible tells us. I think it's the Book of John tells us that he was active in the creation. So he is there from the very first chapter. So we talk about Christ's act in sustaining and upholding the universe. People don't realize that he was involved. He's not just the guy that acquired human form in the New Testament times. He's been with the Father and the Holy Spirit for the beginning. You know, he's an everlasting God. He's a triune God. He became incarnate, of course, in the New Testament times, but he also appeared in pre-incarnate human form in what we call the Christophanies. That's another Christ centered thread that we explore. The Christophanies, they're kind of a subset of theophanies, which is an English term meaning, you know, when the appearances of God in human form. Well, when it's Jesus Christ doing it, it's called a Christophany, and such as when you see in the book, in the Bible, angel of the Lord or messenger of the Lord, and there's some other cases, wrestling with Jacob or annihilating 185,000 Assyrian troops. Different times that Christ is present in the Old Testament in human form. And by the way, when he does that, when Christ appears in human form, he gives us a glimpse of what he's going to be like when he actually becomes incarnate in permanent human form. But it's different from the incarnation because it's just an appearance of a human form. He's not really human in nature yet. But that's another, it's just another example of an appearance in shadowy form that later culminates in Jesus Christ fully. You've got the biblical covenant, and these, before I go to the covenants, let me talk about typology. You've got types, which are persons, places, things, events, ceremonies in the Old Testament that point to Christ in the New Testament, such as the Passover. Think about the Passover event when Israel was delivered from Egypt, and then think about the Passover ceremony celebrating that event where God told Moses that he was going to destroy the firstborn of Pharaoh and all of the Egyptians, but he was going to spare the Israelites. But the way he would do it is they had to sacrifice an unblemished animal, and then they would take the blood of that animal and apply it to their doorframe. Now, this is so fascinating when you think about this, the Christian implications. It had to be an animal that was pure without defect, and blood had to be shed because that's foreshadowing Christ's sacrifice. There is the life is in the blood. There is no remission of sins except for blood sacrifice. And then this is the critical point that I just love. they apply it to their door frame, so when the angel goes through, he will know that he spares them. Now, this means that we need to approach.
You still there, David? Joey, did we lose him?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear
me? Go ahead. Keep going.
So we Christians individually need to appropriate and personally appropriate Christ's finished work on the cross. It's not just collective salvation. So these Israelites applied it to their doorframe and kind of in the shape of the cross about it, which is another just exciting thing. But you don't have to believe that part if you don't want to. We don't need to state more than the facts allow, because we don't want to get far out here. We want credibility. But there's no denying that it was an animal sacrifice, that blood was shed, that it was a pure animal, an unblemished animal, and that you had to apply this sacrifice personally. That's an example of a type. And so we got all kinds of typology from persons, places, events, ceremonies, such as Moses is a type of Christ, Joseph is a type of Christ, in ways that you can't believe. There's just so many examples. All the furniture in the tabernacle in the Old Testament are types of Christ that are fulfilled completely in Christ. Then you go to the covenant, which, beginning with the Edenic, the Adamic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, these covenants are agreements, are contractual agreements between God and the nation of Israel, whereby now normally when people enter into contracts, it's two parties with equal bargaining power or a little bit unequal, but whatever, they negotiate and they use whatever leverage they have and they iron out terms and they agree on them, and then there's a contract. Well, in this case, God is sovereign. When he enters into a covenant with his people, he sets the terms. Now, it usually involves obligations on the part of both parties and promises on the part of both parties, but that's what these covenants are. So he enters into covenants, and from the very beginning, when at the very time that he administered judgment on Adam and Eve, in Genesis 3:15, he gives us the first promise of the gospel called the Proto-Evangelium, and it's also the first messianic prophecy, because he's talking to the serpent, representing the snake, and tells him that he will put enmity, hostility, between him and the seed of the woman, and between him and the woman, and between her offspring and his offspring, meaning that there's going to be spiritual warfare between Satan and Christ throughout history. And he's going to then, he says, Christ will bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Well, what this really means, and I used to believe this was far-fetched when I first became a Christian, and people
right.
like Norman Geisler and Josh McDowell said that was a messianic prophecy. I said, you got to be kidding me. You guys have got to be more.
You're stretching, man. You're stretching. Yeah.
Yeah. And now I think it's an awesome prophecy, because there is no other seed of the woman in the history of the world. No other man, no other human being was just born of a woman, not of a man. Jesus Christ was born of Mary, a woman, but sired by the Holy Spirit. He didn't have a human father. So that's clearly a reference to Christ. We know it is anyway, because Paul in Galatians 4:4 confirms it. And then he's putting hostility between Satan and Christ, and we know that, of course. But here's the cool part. He's going to allow Satan to bruise Christ's heel. Well, nobody's ever died from a heel injury, so we know he's going to administer punishment to Christ, hurt him in some way, but Christ is going to kill him because he's going to bruise his head, and you do have fatal blows when you do the head. So Christ goes to the cross voluntarily. Satan could not injure Christ if Christ didn't allow him to, but Christ voluntarily goes to the cross for our benefit and substitutionarily sacrifices for us. And in the very process of allowing Satan to bruise his heel, he kills Satan, sin, and death, because he comes back in 3 days in his resurrection glory and completely destroys Satan's nefarious plan for mankind. And so it's amazing to me that occurs, that we see that all the seculars say God's a mean God in the Old Testament. He promised redemption from the very first.
All right, hold the thought, David. We're going to come back. He needs more enthusiasm, doesn't he, ladies and gentlemen? That's David Limbaugh, his new book, The Emmaus Code, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament. You want to get this for Christmas. We got one more segment with David. Don't go away. I'm Frank Turek.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you. Dr. Brown on his way to India to minister there. Please pray for him. I have been on Dr. Brown's program a few times and have guest hosted, had the privilege to do that. Today in this half hour, at least for the next this segment here, I'm talking to my friend David Limbaugh. If you're just tuning in, his new book is called The Emmaus Code, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament. And for those of you that have gotten the first half hour of this program, David has a lot to say, as you know, and this book has even more, so you need to get it. It's a perfect book for Christmas. Now, David, this is a very short segment. We just got a few minutes, but you were talking about Jesus in the Old Testament, and you were talking about typology and how Jesus is typified in some Old Testament characters. What? Give us one other way that you find Jesus is found in the Old Testament. You there, David? For some reason, we're having technical trouble here. Let me see if I can get him back on. David, you there? David? Well, for some reason, we can't seem to get David on. See what you can do, Joey. Just bring him back on if you can get him. We did have him, but suddenly he's gone. Anyway, this new book, The Emmaus Code, is a book that I had the privilege of reading prior to its publication and put an endorsement on it. And as he was saying earlier, this is the one book that he would have, and I think I would have, if I wanted to understand the Old Testament when I was particularly a new believer, because it's so difficult to understand the context of the Old Testament, the historical context, who the characters are, what the geography is, what's really going on. And you need that in many cases to understand really what is being said there. And this book, The Emmaus Code, points out that the Old Testament is filled with stories, with prophecies, with typology, with other aspects that point directly to the Savior, Jesus Christ. The entire Bible is about Jesus. And in fact, that's what Jesus said as he was on the road to Emmaus with his disciples. In fact, let's go to that passage very quickly. Jesus says in Luke 24, as he's walking along with them, he says, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them named Cleopas asked him, "Are you the only visitor in Jerusalem who does not know what has just happened here?" Ironically, friends, he was the only one that did really know. Anyway, Jesus asked, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "About Jesus of Nazareth. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see." He said to them, "How foolish," Jesus saying to them, "how foolish you are and slow of heart to believe all the prophets that have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." Oh, man, I would have loved to have heard that. But that's really what this book is about, The Emmaus Code. It is about Jesus in the Old Testament. And so if you've ever struggled to understand the Old Testament, if you've ever struggled to understand its relevance to you today, this is the book you need to get. It's well written, it's well researched, it's well documented. And it's pretty comprehensive. It goes through every single book in the Old Testament and shows how Jesus is found in every book. The Emmaus Code by David Limbaugh. And when we come back from the break, we're going to look at some of these different ways Jesus appears in the Old Testament. We're going to dive down on one or two of them. And if you want to join the conversation, you can at 866-34-TRUTH, 866-34-TRUTH. You're on with Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown, back in just a few minutes. Don't go away.
Fire we want, for fire we please.
It's the line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you. Dr. Brown on his way to India. Pray for his trip. I had the opportunity a number of years ago to co-write a book with Dr. Norman Geisler called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And go to a lot of college campuses, high schools, and churches and present the evidence that Christianity is true. And one particular evidence that I think is quite compelling, if you're open to it, is Old Testament prophecy. Now, there's nobody better at this than Dr. Michael Brown. As you know, he's written several books on it. But I had an experience with a gentleman who teaches at our seminary here in Charlotte, Southern Evangelical Seminary, ses.edu. His name is Barry Leventhal. And I tell the story of Barry in I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It happens to be in chapter 13. In 1966, Barry was a young Jewish man. He was basically on the top of the world because he was the offensive captain of the UCLA Bruins football team, and he had just helped win the Rose Bowl. He won the Rose Bowl that year, and the team was predicted to finish last, but they finished first. They won their first ever Rose Bowl championship. He still remembers the game. He's still teaching here at SES. And he says, my life was great. I was a hero. People loved me. He said, my Jewish fraternity chose me as the national athlete of the year, and I basked in all the glory of it. He said, but soon after the Rose Bowl victory, he said, my best friend Kent said that he had come to know Jesus Christ in a personal way. Barry said, look, I had no idea what Kent was talking about. I thought he had always been a Christian. After all, he'd been born into a Christian home, just as I had been born into a Jewish home. Isn't that how a person got a particular religion? You inherited it from your parents, Barry said. But Barry was intrigued by the way Kent's life changed. And Kent said to Barry one day, he said, Barry, I want you to know that I thank God every day for the Jews. And Barry said, well, why would you do that? And Kent's answer surprised him. Kent said, I thank God every day for the Jews for two reasons. First, God used them to give me my Bible. And second, and most important, God used the Jews to bring his Messiah into the world, the one who died for the sins of the world, especially for all of my sins. And Barry said, to this day, I remember the impact of those few simple but true statements. Genuine Christians don't hate the Jews, after all. In fact, they truly love us and are grateful and honored that God has included them by faith into his family forever. Now, a few weeks later, Kent introduced Barry to Hal. Hal who? Hal Lindsey. Those of you who are interested in prophecy probably know the name Hal Lindsey. Well, in the 60s, Hal Lindsey was the Campus Crusade Director for Christ at UCLA. And so one day, Barry and Hal were sitting in a crowded student lounge, and then things got pretty tense because Hal was showing Barry that predictions of the Messiah in the Old Testament were fulfilled by Jesus. Well, how do you think Barry responded? He's in the cafeteria with Hal Lindsey, and he blurts out, how could you do this? Hal said, do what? Use a trick Bible, Barry charged. You got a trick Bible to fool the Jews. And Hal said, what are you talking about, a trick Bible? Barry said, you Christians took those so-called messianic predictions from your own New Testament and then rewrote them into your edition of the Old Testament in order to fool the Jews. But I guarantee you, those messianic prophecies are not in our Jewish Bible. Hal said, no, Barry, that's not it. It's not it at all. Barry said, no, it's a trick Bible. He jumped up from the table. Hal said, no, it's not. I've never had anyone say this before. Please sit down, Barry. Come on, let's talk. People were beginning to stare at them, you know, in the cafeteria there. And Barry said, no, Hal, the relationship's over. Barry, wait a minute. Do you have a Tanakh? Which, as you know, is a Jewish Bible. He says, of course I got a Tanakh. I have one from my bar mitzvah. I haven't looked at it since then, but I have one. So why don't you write these verses down and go ahead and read them in your own Tanakh? Because that'll be a waste of time, Barry said. Those verses aren't in the Tanakh. Please, Hal persisted. Just write down these verses and check them out for yourself. In fact, Hal wrote him down on a piece of paper. He handed it to Barry. So they volleyed back and forth a little bit, and finally, Barry agreed. All right, I'll check them out, but don't call me. I'll call you. So Barry left, never expecting to see Hal again. He didn't check the verses for several days, and then a little guilt began to gnaw at him. And he thought to himself, look, I told Hal I would check them out, so I guess I should at least do that and put this Christianity thing to rest once and for all. Well, that night, Barry dusted off his old Tanakh, the one he hadn't opened since he was 13, and was shocked at what he found. Every prediction Hal had referenced was indeed in the Tanakh. You know what Barry's initial reaction was? I'm in deep trouble. Jesus really is the Messiah. That's what he thought intellectually at that moment. But at that point, his acceptance was only intellectual. He immediately began to worry about the implications if he made his discovery public. He thought, look, if I accept Jesus as Messiah, what will my parents think? What will my Jewish fraternity friends do? What will my rabbi say? And so he had to do a little bit more study. And that one of the references that Hal kept pointing out to him was Isaiah chapter 53. What about Isaiah chapter 53? Well, before we get there, Isaiah chapter 53 is part of the Great Isaiah Scroll. What's the Great Isaiah Scroll? The Great Isaiah Scroll is perhaps the greatest of any of the scrolls found at the Dead Sea Scrolls in Qumran, Israel. This scroll is about 24 feet long. If you go to the Shrine of the Book Museum in Jerusalem today, you can see a replica of it. They have it there. It's in tremendous shape for being a scroll that dates to 150 BC. And this scroll, as I say, was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it contains all of Isaiah, all 66 chapters, including the famous Isaiah chapter 53. And when you read Isaiah chapter 53 and you ask yourself, who does this apply to? What do you say? Let me just read it. I'm going to start in 52 verse 13 and take it to the end of 53. Hopefully we'll get it in before the break. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness, so will he sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. Here's where 53 begins. Who has believed our message? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was a man despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he took up our infirmities, he carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. As a sheep before her shearers is silent, he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. Though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13 through chapter 53. Now, who does that apply to? Who is that about? Barry Leventhal went to his rabbi and asked him. What happened? You'll see when we get back. You're listening to Frank Turek filling in for Dr. Michael Brown on the Line of Fire. Don't go away. Back in just 2 minutes.
Hey, friends, if you are one of our great listeners in Greater Charlotte, North Carolina, listening all over North Carolina, South Carolina, maybe you've been listening to me regularly for over 7 years now, but you've never met me face to face. Well, this is your opportunity to join together. I can't wait to see you. We're having a special listeners banquet, a special Night to Ignite rally. We've never done this before. You'll be blessed. You'll be inspired. You'll be encouraged. Your faith will be built up. It'll be a special, special night. I'll be bringing a word I believe you remember for years to come. David and Jason Benham, the Benham brothers, will be hosting the event with me, and we'll let you know how you can partner together with us as we raise vision, raise funds, advance the kingdom of God together, and provide you with a great meal. So January 28th, put it on your calendar and join me. I'd love to meet you face to face. Go to nighttoignite.com. Nighttoignite.com. Get in your RSVP as soon as you can.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you. Crossexamined.org, co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist in the new book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Pleasure to be with you. I'll be with you the rest of today and tomorrow, Lord willing, as Dr. Brown is ministering in India as we speak. We've been talking today. We started off this program talking about Jesus in the Old Testament. My friend David Limbaugh wrote a new book called The Emmaus Code, Finding Jesus in the Old Testament. Before the break, we were talking about Isaiah chapter 53 and how it appears to point to Jesus. And this scroll that the Dead Sea Scrolls, or one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Isaiah scroll, was found there in Qumran. It dates from before Christ by at least a couple hundred years. It comes from about 150 B.C., so it's at least 180 years before Jesus was crucified. And that particular book, or that particular scroll, you can see if you go, at least a replica of it, at the Isaiah, or I should say the Shrine of the Book Museum there in Jerusalem. When the Hobby Lobby group had their Bible tour coming through, they had a replica of it as well. It's quite amazing, 24 feet long. And just in tremendous shape for being something that's over 2,000 years old. And by the way, that scroll, that Isaiah scroll, helped us see that the scribes of who transmitted the Old Testament over 1,000 years from about 150 B.C., actually 1,100 years to about 1,000 A.D., had done so very precisely because the two scrolls were almost identical. The one that they had, the Masoretic text from about 1,000 A.D. and the Isaiah scroll from 150 B.C., they had seen that, man, these scribes were very accurate in copying this down. I was also mentioning my friend Barry Leventhal, who was a Jewish man, a Jewish young man at UCLA on the Rose Bowl team. And he had been confronted on the UCLA campus in 1966 by Hal Lindsey, who went on to write a number of books on prophecy, as you know. And Hal was trying to say to Barry, look, the Messiah is in your own Old Testament. You can see him. And he highlighted Isaiah chapter 53. And then he asked Barry to go look it up in his Tanakh. And when Barry looked it up, intellectually, he knew that Jesus was the true Messiah. But he still wanted to go to his rabbi and see what the rabbi said about it. In fact, here's what Barry said. He said, And by the way, you can read about all this in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. This is in chapter 13. Barry said, I vividly remember the first time I seriously confronted Isaiah 53, or better still, the first time it seriously confronted me. Being rather confused over the identity of the servant in Isaiah 53, I went to my local rabbi and said to him, Rabbi, I have met some people at UCLA who claim that the so-called servant in Isaiah 53 is none other than Jesus of Nazareth. But I would like to know from you, who is this servant in Isaiah 53? Barry was astonished at what the rabbi said. The rabbi read it and he said, Barry, I must admit that as I read Isaiah 53, it does seem to be talking about Jesus. But since we Jews do not believe in Jesus, it can't be speaking about Jesus. Barry said, I didn't know much about formal logic at that point, but I knew enough to say, you know, that just doesn't sound kosher to me. That kind of logic. He said, not only does the rabbi's so-called reasoning sound circular, it also sounds evasive and even fearful. And Barry went on to say, there are none who are as deaf as those who do not want to hear. Amen to that. And you know what, friends? I find this. As I mentioned earlier, I go to a lot of college campuses, churches, high schools, particularly on college campuses. We have a lot of Q&A. And sometimes the Q&A can get a little tense. People can get a little emotional when you're trying to show that there is a God and they don't want there to be a God. In fact, you can see some of these Q&As, short videos on our website, crossexamined.org, or on our Facebook page, crossexamined.org, or Dr. Frank Turek. Just like those pages and you'll see we put up two or three a day, actually. These little Q&As that go on a college campus. And sometimes I will get a hostile question. And so I'll stop and I'll say, hey, do you mind if I ask you a question? And normally the person will say, sure, go ahead. And this is the question I ask atheists. In fact, this is a question I ask anybody who's not a believer. I think it's a question you might want to put in your mind when you're talking to people about Christianity. Here's the question. The question is this. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? Do you know how many times in recent years I've had atheists yell back at me? No! No! Wait, wait, no, no, wait, no, wait. You claim to be an atheist, a beacon of reason. Never mind if atheism's true, reason doesn't exist. Why? Because if atheism's true, if we're just molecules in motion, if we're just molecular machines, we're not reasoning anyway, we're just reacting. But let's leave that aside. I ask you if Christianity were true and you become a Christian and you say no, how's that reasonable? How's that rational? It's not. You see, the problem isn't in the head, the problem's in the heart. People don't want it to be true. You see, most people are not on a truth quest, they're on a happiness quest. They're going to believe whatever they think's going to make them happy. The problem is that you can do a lot of stupid things over the short term that can appear to make you happy, but over the long term, they are a disaster. The only way to get true joy and contentment is to go straight through truth, and Jesus is the truth. So when Barry said his rabbi sounded fearful about admitting that Isaiah 53 points to Jesus, it was because there are implications if Jesus is truly the Messiah for a rabbi. Implications he doesn't want to deal with. And there are implications on a college campus or for people you talk to when you try and say Jesus is God. You see, people don't want Jesus to be God. Many don't want there to be a God. Why? Because they want to be God. The elephant in the room in most cases is not even evidence. You know what the elephant in the room is? The elephant in the room is morality and accountability. People don't want it. They don't want there to be a God. They don't want morality to exist. They don't want accountability. They want to be God. So the next time you're having a conversation with somebody and you point out the evidence that Christianity's true and they appear to not be in any way impressed by it or even resistant to it, ask them, look, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? See what they say. By the way, these questions and many others are on our app, the Cross-Examined app, two words in the App Store. Check it out, Cross-Examined, two words in the App Store, and I'll be back for the next hour. I'm Frank Turek. Great being with you. See you in the next hour. God bless.
There is something special happening today on The Line of Fire. Join my special guest host, Dr. Frank Turek.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you. Crossexamined.org is the website. Co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist and Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. A privilege to be guest hosting for Dr. Brown. Done it before, been a guest on his show as well. He is on his way to India, so pray for his ministry over there. I'll be with you today and tomorrow. And I want to go back to a tweet that Dr. Brown put out just a couple of weeks ago, actually. Here's what the tweet said. He said, "We know that most Muslims today are not terrorists. We also know that most terrorists today are Muslims," unquote. That was the tweet. He got a lot of blowback for that. You say, why? Is it not true? Of course it's true. Most Muslims are not terrorists, but most terrorists are Muslims. Well, I want to talk today in this hour about political correctness and Islam. And I want to try and cover four basic points and hopefully get your input on this. Open up the phone lines at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. I want to cover what is Islam, particularly what some will call radical Islam. Actually, you could look at it the other way. I'll get to another way of putting this. Should we call it radical Islam, or is radicalism Islam really true Islam? And people who aren't jihadists, the apostates, some would say that, and I'll explain why. Secondly, what is political correctness? Where does it come from? Why do we have it? What is it about? And then what issues should Christian consider regarding immigration, particularly Muslim immigration? And let me say to you, no matter what position you advocate, you are advocating one value over another. In fact, all political positions involve favoring one moral value over another moral value. You say you can't legislate morality? Newsflash, ladies and gentlemen, all laws legislate morality. And that was, in fact, that was the first book I had the opportunity to co-write with Dr. Geisler. It was called Legislating Morality. I was so tired of hearing people say you can't legislate morality. That's what all laws do. All laws declare one behavior right and the opposite behavior wrong. The only question is, whose morality will we legislate? That's the question. I'd also like to ask the question, how can we stop or prevent terrorist attacks, particularly here in America? So what is Islam? What is political correctness? What should we think about immigration? And how can we stop or prevent terrorist attacks here in America? That's what I'd like to cover here in this hour. And hopefully you can join us at 866-34-TRUTH, 866-34-TRUTH. And let me point out one thing about Islam. Unfortunately, there are people out there who think Islam is like a race. It's like skin color. Islam is not a race. It's an ideology. It's a political viewpoint. It's like fascism or communism. And when I say Islam, I'm talking about the Islam written in the Quran and the Islam that Muhammad demonstrated and the Islam that has been going on in many ways for the past 1400 years. A totalitarian religious state that runs everything, that sets up Sharia law and governs all parts of life. There's no freedom. There's no Bill of Rights in Islam. There's no freedom of speech or freedom of religion. Everything is imposed upon the subjects of Islam. It's an expansionist, imperialistic ideology. So this idea here, there, that you can be Islamophobic, like it's some way attributed to race, is irrelevant. Race has no bearing on your behavior, but Islam is a belief system that does affect your behavior. Now, what is it? Is it radical in the sense that it believes in jihad? Or are the jihadists really the radical ones that aren't believing in true Islam? Let's deal with that when we come back from the break and then get to your phone calls. 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Frank Turek filling in with you for Dr. Michael Brown. Our website, crossexamined.org. Crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. Back in 2 minutes.
Send it, Lord. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you of crossexamined.org. Dr. Brown is on his way to India, so pray for his trip as he goes. Today we are talking about, in this hour anyway, Islam and political correctness. What is Islam? What's the truth about it? And what is political correctness? And why does it seem to have us confused over this issue of Islam? You know, right after, the Friday after 9/11 in 2001, remember, 9/11 was a Tuesday, and mosques are in operation for services on Friday. So just 3 days after 9/11, in the King Fahd Mosque in Culver City, California, the imam there was talking about the terrorist attacks that happened a few days prior and was denouncing them, and someone stood up in the mosque there and said, "You can't say that. You're disobeying the Quran." In other words, you can't disagree with these attacks. You're disobeying the Quran. In fact, Ayatollah Khomeini, the man who led the revolution in Iran, overthrew the Shah back in 1979 when our hostages were taken, he said this: Islam says, kill all unbelievers, kill them, put them to the sword, and scatter their armies. There are hundreds of Quranic psalms and sayings of the Prophet Muhammad urging Muslims to value war and to fight. Are there? If you look through the Quran, I'll just read a couple of verses from the Quran. Surahs 8 and 9. A surah is a chapter in the Quran. There's 114 surahs. They go from the longest to the shortest, except for the first surah is not the longest. The second one is. And in Surah 8, which is thought to be one of the last surahs written, 8 and 9, it says this, Surah 8:12, "When your Lord spoke to the angels, I will be with you, therefore establish the faithful. I will cast dread into the hearts of the infidels, strike off their heads then, and strike off from them every fingertip." In the next surah, Surah 9:5, it says, "Slay the idolaters wherever you find them, and take them captive, and besiege them, and prepare them for every ambush." A few verses later, in Surah 9:29, it says, "Fight those who do not believe in Allah." The next verse says, "May Allah destroy the Christians and the Jews." And I could go on. But there's verse after verse in the Quran about killing unbelievers. Now, who are the orthodox ones in Islam? Some will say, including all of our presidents, seem to say, well, Islam is a great religion that has been hijacked by these terrorists. Well, in fact, if you're going to base a world religion, a monotheistic world religion, on the texts that guide them, then actually the people who are not committing jihad are the apostates. The people that are actually committing jihad are just following what the text says. And I know this is politically incorrect to say, but that's the truth. Just read them. Now, I'm glad that most Muslims do not believe in violent jihad. But if you read the texts, if you look at the example of Muhammad, and you look at the past 1,400 years of world history, you will see that jihad has been going on that long. This stuff didn't happen or didn't begin at 9/11. This isn't 10 minutes old. This has been going on for 1,400 years. In fact, even in our country's history, you talk about Thomas Jefferson had to go up against the Barbary pirates. Who were the Barbary pirates? They were Muslims. In fact, the Marine Corps hymn talks about from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. That had to do with fighting the Muslims who were interfering with our shipping. So Islam, if you read it, if you're going to base what Islam is on the texts of Islam and the example of the founder and the history of what's going on, then you would say that Islam and jihad are together. Jihad is part of Orthodox Islam. I wish it wasn't that way, but that's just the way it is. Look, I tell you the truth. You decide whether or not you want to believe it. You can look it up for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Look up the Quran. You can go look up the Quran online right now. Go to chapters 8 and 9. Read about it. Go to the website answeringislam.org, which is a great website. and deals with some of the arguments that Muslims put forth to say their worldview is true. Go to answeringislam.org to read more about that. Again, Islam is not a race. Islam is a belief system. And I think that we ought to be wary of it because it's a belief system that preaches violence against those who are unbelievers in Islam. Now, George H.W. Bush, and by the way, if you want to join our program a little bit later, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-34-TRUTH, that's 866-348-7884. What do you think about all this, Islam, political correctness? I'm filling in for Michael Brown. My name's Frank Turek, and our website, crossexamine.org. President George H.W. Bush had a speech in the University of Michigan back in 1991. Here's what he said about political correctness. Quote, "The notion of political correctness has ignited controversy across the land, and although the movement arises from the laudable desire to sweep away the debris of racism and sexism and hatred, it replaces old prejudice with new ones. It declares certain topics off limits, certain expressions off limits, even certain gestures off limits," unquote. He's exactly right. I mean, in one sense, political correctness has the laudable morality behind it, saying, look, we don't want people to be bigoted. We don't want people to continue in their racist views, these kinds of things. So that's laudable about it. The problem is it puts a new orthodoxy in place, a new prejudice in place, and it shuts down free speech and freedom of association and freedom of religion. A couple of professors from the University of Pennsylvania talked about the speech codes that are very prevalent at American universities, and they said this. He said speech codes in U.S. universities mandate a redefined notion of freedom based on the belief that the imposition of a moral agenda on a community is justified, a view which requires less emphasis on individual rights and more on assuring historically oppressed persons the means of achieving equal rights. So-called equal rights. They go on to say our colleges and universities do not offer protection of fair rules, equal justice, and consistent standards. They encourage students to bring charges of harassment against those opinions or expressions offend them. At almost every college and university, students are deemed members of historically oppressed groups. They have that in quotes. Above all, women, blacks, gays, and Hispanics are informed that during orientation that their campuses are teeming with illegal or intolerable violations of the right not to be offended, unquote. The right not to be offended. My friend Everett Piper, who is the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, said this on Fox News. He was just on yesterday. He said, universities are not daycare. This is not a daycare. This is a university. If you can't handle ideas that you're offended by, move on to go somewhere else. I mean, please. By the way, what's the number one offended minority in the world, ladies and gentlemen? What do you think it is? Nope. The number one offended minority in the world is Christians, evangelical Christians, Bible-believing Christians. The number one oppressed minority around the world is evangelical Christians. Yet in the minds of some on the left and in Islam, Christians can not only be offended, they should be persecuted. So political correctness is not about protecting all minorities, it is about protecting the approved minorities. That's what it's about. I mean, it's crazy what's going on in our country right now, on college campuses in particular. You're shutting down freedom of religion, freedom of speech, because somebody just doesn't want to hear a view that they disagree with. Well, look, friends, you're never going to learn anything if you only hear what you agree with. How can you learn anything if you don't open yourself up to new ideas? You can't. You have to open yourself up to new ideas. This is infantile to say that you offended me, so therefore you shouldn't be able to say what you're going to say. Wait a minute. You're offending me by saying I can't express my deeply held beliefs. Look, we don't want to be offensive, obviously. We don't want to add insult or offense to the gospel, which can be found offensive already. But we can't just shut down and say these are the only approved views. Who is going to decide what the approved views are? So it's one other thing that's pretty amazing to me about all this. It seems that the political left is aligning with Islam. And I don't understand that alliance, because if Sharia law is ever put in place, the first people that are going to be in trouble are the liberals. So it's a very strange alliance that you have here between the political left and Islam. So today we're talking about, for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to The Line of Fire. Frank Turek filling in for Dr. Michael Brown, who is on assignment here, going to India. So pray for him. And when we come back, we'll get to your phone calls at 866-34-TRUTH. What do you think about Islam? Political correctness? What should we do about it? What can we do about it? How about immigration? Let's talk about it all. Frank Turek with you back in just 2 minutes.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek with you, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. Crossexamined.org is our website. And I'm just looking on the internet here as we're speaking. For those of you that are watching live, or I should say listening live, apparently there's been a mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. We don't have a lot of details at this point, but we need to pray for everybody involved, particularly the victims and the law enforcement personnel involved. I don't have a lot of details. I'm looking at a news report right now on the internet. Just happened to click on the Drudge Report and linked over to CNN. Could be as many as 20 people were shot. So just a very somber time. And we really need to pray that the victims, their injuries are not life-threatening. Again, I don't know any of the details at this point. And that the law enforcement officers will be protected and be able to resolve the situation quickly. For those of you who don't know, San Bernardino is to the east of Los Angeles, just before you get to the mountains out there. It's about 60 miles due east of Los Angeles. We're talking today about Islam and political correctness. And if you'd like to join the program, 866-34-TRUTH, that's 866-348-7884. Let's start on the phone lines, and we will go to Kimberly listening in Wilson, North Carolina. Kimberly, you're on with Frank Turek. Go right ahead.
Hey, I originally called you. Thanks for your talking about this subject. I have a Muslim coworker, and we have a good relationship, and it's been about 6 months. He knows that I'm a Christian, and that I, you know, believe in Jesus Christ. And I was wanting to know, well, he had given me a Quran, and I wanted to give it. He asked me to give him a Bible, and in his language, he's only been here for a few years. He's from Iraq, I'm sorry, not Iran. And and so I'm not sure what language he speaks or what resources there are for him, but just wanted to share my thoughts about, you know, not letting the world overwhelm us, you know, that really dealing with the community around you where you can make a difference, to be a resource for someone, that for God to use you, you know, to bring resources to people who are looking for God, maybe in the wrong place. And I mean, even though he was raised a Muslim, you know, he calls me his sister, which is kind of odd because, you know, I say Jesus Christ and God, and so I don't know what else to say, but do you have any resources?
Well, that's a great question, and it really depends on the language. You know, there's several languages spoken in Iraq. Of course, Arabic is probably the top language, but then you have Kurdish as well. You have Syriac, Aramaic, a few others. So you may want to try and ask him what his native tongue is, Kimberly. And I'm sure that you can find a Bible online somewhere that would have that. I would contact the Billy Graham organization actually about that. Also, that or the Josh McDowell organization, josh.org. I know Josh has some resources that they've translated into these languages. I think maybe his More Than a Carpenter book has been translated into that. That might be a good book to give a Muslim young man.
Great.
And there have, of course, been several other works translated as well. But it would be good just to see what his native tongue is, and then do a little hunt for it. I'm sure you can find something. I don't know off the top of my head specifically, but those organizations, Billy Graham, also probably the Wycliffe organization. I know they're hard at translating into different languages. So, yeah, you'll be able to find it if you just do a little bit of digging. Now, did I understand that you did some work in Iraq?
No, he came here. He just became a citizen, actually. And
okay.
I was surprised to learn, you know, well, that he can vote. That kind of bothered me a little. I know that might sound terrible for him to have only been here for a little while. But, I mean, I know that's not your issue today. But we work together, and he's a really great guy, and he's a great worker. He has a great attitude, and I know he's a faithful Muslim. And I want to try to bridge the gap between the differences, not by hiding what I believe, but by telling him, you know, this is what I believe. You can believe what you want to believe, but you know, just trying to find a way to. You know, we have to be a light,
there's a couple
kind to him.
Yeah, there's a couple of books you may want to get that will help you in this regard. First of all, the website I mentioned earlier is very helpful. Answeringislam.org is very helpful as a website. But my co-author, Dr. Norman Geiser, wrote a book with a former Muslim called Answering Islam, which is a great book for someone who is interested in juxtaposing the two worldviews or the two religious worldviews and then giving some evidence as to why the Christian worldview is true. But with somebody like this, a lot of times it's just asking a lot of questions. And the app that we have, the Cross-Examined app, will be helpful in that regard. If you get the Cross-Examined app, two words, there are questions you can ask of anybody and just guide the conversation by asking these questions. Because, Kimberly, when somebody says something, it's not your job to refute what they say. It's that person's job to support what he says. So if he says the Quran is true, my question will be, well, what evidence do you have for that position? You know, why do you think it's true? I was at the University of Michigan not long ago, about a month ago now, and a Muslim asked me a question in front of the whole group, and he was trying to tell me that the evidence for the Quran as being true is the Quran's a miracle. The book itself, I said to him, well, first of all, that if writing a book makes you a miracle worker, I've done five miracles. You know, I mean, writing a book is not a miracle. The question is, why is the Quran true? And just saying it's a miracle as an assertion is not very persuasive. So you have to look at the evidence and determine it. Now, I would suggest that if you're dealing with a man, it's very difficult for – given their culture, for you as a woman to interact with a man on this issue. It's just the way culturally things are there. So if there was another man, another Christian man who could interact with him one-on-one, it probably would work out better. I'm just talking pragmatically here.
Yeah, he's younger. He's 20 years younger than me. I sound young, but I'm older. And, you know, it's more like a son kind of looking at him as a young man.
Right.
That I care about his salvation. And really want to give him resources, but I agree about women ministering to men as a tricky thing. So that's why I'm trying to give him stuff in writing that he can look at in his own language. And he's given me some great resources. I really appreciate your time.
Well, I thank you for what you're doing and caring for Muslims. We need to care more for them. And that gets to the immigration issue as well, which maybe we'll talk in the second hour here, Kimberly, or second half hour, I should say, because it's very difficult to witness to Muslims, particularly when they're in Syria. But if we can get some of them here, maybe we can have a chance with them. I know that puts us at, some say, at a security risk, but we've got to have the opportunity to reach out to these people, and having them here is a way to do that. So thank you for what you're doing, Kimberly, and thank you so much for the call. If you'd like to join the program, I'm Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-34-TRUTH. What about Islam? What about political correctness? What about immigration? How can we prevent terrorist attacks here? What do we do? That's what we're talking about today, friends. Back in just 2 minutes. Don't go away.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown, co-author of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Also, Correct, Not Politically Correct, How Same-Sex Marriage Hurts Everyone. I've been a guest host before, and I've been a guest on Dr. Brown's show. It's a privilege to be here. Today, we're talking about this issue of Islam and political correctness. And in the first half hour, we talked a little bit about what Islam is, what it believes, particularly with regard to jihad. And then we talked a little bit about political correctness and how political correctness is just a totalitarian way of shutting people up you don't agree with, unfortunately. And it goes against, obviously, our right to free speech and freedom of religion. The question is, what do you do about it? Well, you point it out. You know, you point out, why are you trying to oppress or suppress me when I try and say something that I believe? The only way to learn is to be open to new ideas, and if you suppress all the ideas you don't agree with, you're never going to get anywhere. But now let's talk about this issue of immigration, particularly Muslim immigration. I was at a conference last week in Atlanta. It's called Evangelical Theological Society Conference. It's like 2,000 evangelical scholars get there, and they talk about all these different issues. And a couple of individuals were in one of the sessions that I attended. One is Nabil Qureshi, a former Muslim who became a Christian, works for Ravi Zacharias now, or Ravi Zacharias Ministries, wrote a book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. Great book. And he was talking about the fact that we want Muslims to come to this country so we can reach them. It's hard to reach out to people who are in Syria and these closed Muslim countries with the gospel. We just can't get to them as well as we can. He has pointed out that many Muslims who are truly seeking the truth have been visited by angels or visions of Jesus. In fact, Nabil had a vision himself that helped bring him to Christ. But in any event, he's saying, look, we've got to have some immigration, or we should have some immigration. We can't just shut the doors completely. And as Christians, we should want them to come here. To which John Warwick Montgomery, another Christian there, an older gentleman who's been an apologist for many years, said, well, let's not confuse tolerance with stupidity. In fact, President Obama said, we don't have a religious test for immigrants. Actually, we do. We always have. My question is, do you have a religious murder, or do you have a test for murder? You know, I mean, if somebody wants to come in here and murder people, would we let them in? No. In fact, I submit to you that if there were organizations of people getting together and meeting in a building and saying, here's how we can plot to murder people here in America, like say it was some sort of white supremacist group or something like that, we would arrest those people for conspiracy. But yet, if they're in a mosque, somehow we allow that. Actually, France is beginning not to allow that. They just arrested some people today. They closed down, I think, the third mosque that was a mosque preaching violent jihad. But the point I'm trying to make here is that you just can't get cover for religious freedom if you are attempting to engage in murder. I mean, there are limits to religious freedom. You can't sacrifice children and call it, well, it's just my religious freedom. You can't blow people up and call it, well, it's just my religious freedom. That's why I said earlier that no matter what position you advocate regarding religious freedom or immigration or anything else, you're advocating one value over another value. All political positions involve favoring one moral value over another moral value. All political positions legislate morality, in other words. The question is, whose morality? Look, if Christians are being persecuted in Syria, we ought to give them precedence when they come to this country. They're seeking refuge. They need it. But what about Muslims? Should we let some in? We'll get to it and get to your phone calls right after the break. I'm Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. 866-34-TRUTH if you want to join us. 866-34-TRUTH. Check out our website, crossexamined.org.
Hey, friends, if you are one of our great listeners in Greater Charlotte, North Carolina, listening all over North Carolina, South Carolina, maybe you've been listening to me regularly for over 7 years now, but you've never met me face to face, well, this is your opportunity to join together. I can't wait to see you. We're having a special listeners banquet, a special Night to Ignite rally. We've never done this before. You'll be blessed. You'll be inspired. You'll be encouraged. Your faith will be built up. It'll be a special, special night. I'll be bringing a word I believe you remember for years to come. David and Jason Benham, the Benham brothers, will be hosting the event with me, and we'll let you know how you can partner together with us as we raise vision, raise funds, advance the kingdom of God together, and provide you with a great meal. So January 28th, put it on your calendar and join me. I'd love to meet you face to face. Go to nighttoignite.com. Nighttoignite.com. Get in your RSVP as soon as you can.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown,
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution.
Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Turek filling in for Dr. Michael Brown, who's heading to India for ministry. I'm with you today and tomorrow, Lord willing. Our website, crossexamined.org, crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org, if you want to learn more about what we're doing. Today we're talking about the issue of Islam and political correctness. We talked earlier in the program about what is Islam regarding jihad, what's radical, what is orthodox. We talked a little bit about political correctness. We talked about how Islam is not a race as well. It's a belief system. And we also talked a little bit about immigration. We're in the middle of a conversation about immigration. And I was saying that there are some people out there who are Christians who are saying we want some Muslims to come here. We want to be able to reach them for Jesus. And we certainly want people who are under persecution in other countries to have the opportunity to come here if we can properly vet them. Now, obviously, we can't open our borders to everyone. But President Obama said we don't have a religious test. Actually, we do. We've always had a religious test because the number one reason people are persecuted and need refuge is because they're being persecuted because of their religion. So if Christians are being persecuted for their religion in Syria by ISIS, they ought to be given the front of the line to come here. That only makes sense. The question is, what about allowing other Muslims to come here? How can we vet them? How can we be sure that we're not inviting terrorists into our country? That's a question we all have to deal with. Let me go to the phone lines, and we'll start with Jason listening in Iowa. Jason, you're a first-time listener, first-time caller. Thanks for calling in. Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I turned on the radio and heard you guys talking about radical Islam.
Yes.
My dad is from Iran. He came over here in 1979 when the revolution was going on over there.
Yes.
And we're not fans of the Iranian government by any means. He's, to this day, he cannot go back or else they might keep him. So it's a terrible situation for that. I was interested because calling from Iowa, the issue of radical Islam, my question essentially is, are we actually feeding radical Islam by talking about it nonstop? Because from what I see, 99.99% of Muslims are peaceful. Muslim means he who submits. All the terrorism I see over here in the U.S. is done by, white people on prescription drugs. So what is the solution for this?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I think that we have to talk about it because, unfortunately, many in our government and many around our universities want to put their heads in the sand and say that Islam has nothing to do with terrorism. In fact, Hillary Clinton said that the other day. I said, "What? Are you delusional? This has been going on for 1,400 years." And I don't know if you tuned in early enough, Jason, when we were talking about the verses in the Quran that advocate violent jihad, or the fact that violent jihad was part of what Muhammad did and was part of what the Muslim history has been. But we have to be clear and point out that, as you pointed out, yes, the vast, vast majority of Muslims don't believe that. But the question is, how many in the minority do believe it, and it's a significant number, Jason, a significant
exactly.
number. Even if only if 5% believe it, that's still several hundred million people, right?
Yeah. Well, and here's a little bit more of my background. I'm Rastafarian, so I read from the Bible and the Quran. From what I've been able to gather thus far is the people that are being targeted by ISIS or Al-Qaeda, they're uneducated, first and foremost. They don't have access to schools, to the internet. There's the same amount of information that we do, and their history is radically different. Like you just said, the 1,400 years that most of us don't learn about over here and don't talk about over here in the U.S. And so I guess I just wanted to give more of my background before starting going into the discussion. I forgot that part. I'm not a university student. I went to school for law, but this is beyond. This is my concern is as just an American citizen that we're heading toward a third world war, whether it's through economic means or just military might, and this seems to be the potential catalyst for what starts it. And the thing I've observed over the past 10 years of paying attention to politics and being involved very intimately is that we aren't willing to actually engage the so-called enemy. We tend to just shout them down, and so nothing gets done, and we just end up pointing, well, it's those brown people over there, and we must hate them because they're trying to kill us. So I don't think they're fighting us for our freedoms. I don't think they hate us because we're Americans. I think they hate us because they simply, well, they don't even hate us. They hate the people who are dropping bombs on them. And that's what I think is.
But Jason, this predates the United States. This goes all the way back to Muhammad himself. This goes all the way back to the Quran.
Sure,
so this is not history. Can the U.S. exacerbate things by doing certain things that people over there don't like? Well, of course, but that's not the reason that they're blowing themselves up generally, and that they're committing jihad, violent jihad against the West. It's because it's part of their scriptures, it's part of their example from their founder, and it's been part of their history for 1,400 years. I see the exact opposite happening for what you're saying. I see us kowtowing to jihadists. I see us, rather than being more direct about it and speaking the truth about it, being too politically correct about it and not identifying the people who are doing this as really the enemy. I mean, let me ask you, if you were the president of the United States right now and you had the authority to address this issue directly, what would you do about it? What would you say about it?
I would try and sit down with the world leaders, and not necessarily Syria, but more in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and just say, I'd bring them all to the table like Bill Clinton tried to do. And I'd say, can we sit down, and is there any amount of negotiation that we can even begin to have peace talks? Now, I don't know.
Let me ask you this. How can you have peace talks with people who say, A, their mission is to eradicate you, and B, they believe that lying to unbelievers is a good thing?
I'm going to answer carefully. Those aren't the ones that I'd even want to talk to. See, by trying to engage someone with that mindset, they've already won. That's where my whole original question came into is, are we feeding them by talking with them? So when I say world leaders, I mean the actual leaders of Islam, not the ones claiming to be leaders of Islam. Because I could tomorrow go out, commit an act of terrorism, cite Deuteronomy from chapter 13, 6 through 9, where it says, stone, kill anyone who doesn't believe the same God you do, and then say, hey, the Bible told me to do it. Well, that doesn't make me a Christian. That doesn't make me a leader. So if they're going to use the Quran to say, hey, this historical context of a war that happened back in primitive times is the reason I, in 2015, want to strap a bomb to my chest and go kill children, they're not even worthy of being brought to the table. So they will eradicate themselves simply by opening their mouth to any reasonable person. The problem is that over there, we're feeding them ammunition by engaging them. That's how I see it.
Well, I think we have to engage. We in some way have to militarily engage them. Otherwise, if we don't use force, they're going to use force on us. I know it's a hard thing to say, but as Francis Schaeffer once said, in a fallen world, some amount of force is going to be necessary. And that's what governments are instituted among men to do, to protect innocent people from evil. The question is, how do you do that? Use that force? Where do you use it? When do you use it? Those are all very complicated questions. But if you're not going to... I'm glad you're not going to sit down with people who are jihadists and people who have made it their mission to kill you. Well, those are the people we have to address somehow. So addressing the other leaders of Islam isn't going to do much trouble, because if they're not out for us, there's no reason to talk to them, in the sense that we have to say to them, stop trying to kill us, because they're not trying to kill us. It's the other Muslims that are. But thank you for your call, Jason. I appreciate it. We're about out of time here. You're listening to The Line of Fire, and I'm Frank Turek, filling in for Dr. Michael Brown. We'll get to your phone calls after the break. Don't go away.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Frank Turek with you, ladies and gentlemen. Dr. Brown on his way to India. Pray for his ministry there. I'll be with you today, the rest of just the last segment here, and then tomorrow, Lord willing. And tomorrow I'm going to have he's not a doctor, but he should be. J. Warner Wallace, the cold case homicide detective. He's got a book called Cold Case Christianity and the brand new one called God's Crime Scene. You're not going to want to miss this talk that I have with Jim Wallace. He's been on Dateline 4 times because he solved cold case murders from 30 years ago. And he applies those principles to the greatest homicide of all time, the homicide of Jesus. And he also applies some of the cold case principles to the question of God's existence. So you're not going to want to miss our talk tomorrow on The Line of Fire. Today we've been talking about Islam, political correctness, immigration, those kinds of issues. We still got a line open if you're interested. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. What should we do about people who are Muslims who want to come to this country? How do we vet them? How many should we let in? What should Christians be concerned with? Nabil Qureshi, my friend who was a former Muslim, he's now a Christian, said, look, we can't have the spirit of fear here. We want to reach these people. Yet on the other hand, governments are instituted among men to protect their citizens from evil. So there has to be a balance here between safety and obviously the concern to reach people with the gospel. So how do we go about doing that? And no matter what position you take, you are prioritizing a value, whether it's trying to help people or trying to ensure that the people here already in the country are safe and not going to be blown up by a terrorist. And again, you always have to say this because people are in the politically correct mode here. I'm not saying all Muslims are terrorists. As Jason, the last caller, pointed out, the vast majority are not terrorists. Thankfully, they're not. However, all recent terrorists have been Muslims, and this has been going on for 1,400 years. Not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists tend to be Muslims. And they're getting this from the Quran. They're getting this from their founder, Muhammad. They're getting this from their 1,400-year history. So we have to keep that in mind. Now, how can we prevent or stop terrorist attacks in America? So far, we've done a pretty decent job, but it's probably impossible, unless you're going to have a military state, to avoid them all. Andy McCarthy, writing in the National Review. In fact, Andy McCarthy was an attorney who has written some books, but he originally prosecuted the blind sheikh, I think it was, that tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And he had an article a couple of weeks ago in National Review, and he was talking about terrorism and how to stop it. And he also talked about this idea of religious affiliation. And can we use a religious affiliation, or can we use religion to vet people before they come in the country? And his answer is, of course, yes. He said, it is against our law, and I'm reading from Andy McCarthy's article right now. He says, it is against our law for a person to be targeted for investigative attention solely because of a person's race, ethnicity, or religious affiliation. But If the person's conduct is suggestive of criminal activity, terrorism, or espionage, that is a valid basis for triggering an investigation. Once there is a valid basis for an investigation, it is relevant, it is common sense, to account for religious affiliation to the extent it may shed light on a suspect's actions and state of mind. As I said before, Islam is not a race. Christianity is not a race. Buddhism is not a race. Race has nothing to do with your behavior. There's no necessary connection between your race and your behavior, but there may be a necessary connection between your religion and your behavior. McCarthy goes on to say, he was on a Steve Bannon show, a radio show. He said, I opined on the Steve Bannon show that the only sensible strategy for preventing terrorist atrocities like the one last week in Paris, he said this a couple of weeks ago, so the Paris thing happened on the 13th of November, as you know. He said, there are two ways to prevent terrorism. A, number one, intelligence collection regarding radical mosques, which are not hard to distinguish from non-radical mosques. And B, the cultivation of cooperation from American Muslim community, from the American Muslim community, including informants. So if you do those two things, if you identify the radical mosques, or the mosques preaching Surahs 8 and Surah 9 from the Quran, and you cultivate intelligence from American Muslims, you can really do a good job of preventing terrorist attacks. McCarthy goes on to say this, Steve and I noted that this was the very successful New York Police Department approach after 9/11, but it had recklessly been abandoned by Mayor de Blasio's administration. Mayor de Blasio is the current mayor of New York City. He goes on to say, McCarthy does, and I've previously explained the Obama's administration's countering violent extremism strategy similarly rejects the prudent NYPD surveillance approach pioneered by the former commissioner Ray Kelly. In other words, Obama, President Obama, is not doing those two things that McCarthy is recommending. Figuring out who the radical mosques are and getting information from American Muslims. He goes on to say, McCarthy does, Obama prefers to have our law enforcement officers retrained by the administration's partners in the Islamic communities, including Islamist organizations linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, which insist that Islamist terror has nothing to do with Islam. So there, that's where Hillary Clinton gets it from. It's the politically correct, put your head in the sand way of saying we're not going to in any way connect terrorism with Islam. In any way, which is just nonsense and everybody knows it. Stop being politically correct. It's time to be correct, not politically correct. Political correctness is going to be the death of people. It literally is dangerous in this case because you're not admitting that you have an enemy and you need to identify who that enemy is. Oh, you say they're not our enemy. Well, they've made us their enemies. They stated all the time. They even have videos out there of them blowing up the White House. Please. You must admit what the truth is. If you can't admit the truth, how can you lead people properly? You can't. Before you can deal with a problem, you have to admit you have one. So political correctness is something that we just can't tolerate, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen. It's time we spoke the truth. And we spoke the truth rightly and in love. It's not loving to avoid the truth, especially if by avoiding the truth you're putting people in physical jeopardy, and we are. We've got to speak the truth. And thank God for people like Dr. Michael Brown here on the Line of Fire who speak the truth. Now, I'm going to have a former Muslim on my program at crossexamined.org. It's on the same American Family Radio Network that Dr. Brown is on the weekend. You can check out the details on our website, crossexamined.org. The show airs on Saturday, so if you're interested in that, you can check it out. You can also get our app, the free app, the Cross Examined app, two words in the app store, Cross Examined. It has all our podcasts on there. So when I interview Abdu Meri this weekend, you can hear. He's a former Muslim. He'll tell us a little bit more about Islam and how to witness to Muslims, and he'll have many other insights, so you want to check that out. And I hope to see you here tomorrow with cold case homicide detective Jay Warner Wallace. I'm Frank Turek. Great being with you, friends. God bless. Thanks to Betsy and Joey and Matt there, the engineers, and the call screeners. I'll see you tomorrow, friends. God bless.